Good morning. Fall fell this week. It's my time of year now. I came back from the gym yesterday morning and I was running around and my wife said, "Oh, you're back." This is the season where I thrive. I even got my flu shot. I'm all stocked up. Take this from the word of an old guy: when you get that flu shot, they don't tell you this, but just going to wipe you out for 24 hours. I sit in a chair like this, but I'm prepared now to face anything. So together we will. Last Sunday in the second week of this month's series entitled Reset, we looked at what Jesus taught his followers about forgiveness and the opportunity he gives everyone who believes in Jesus to restart their lives with new focus and purpose. We learned that when a person receives the redemption that's been made available by the death and resurrection of Christ, they are then immersed in the grace, mercy, and love of God, which washes them clean from sin and allows them to go forward on a new path. From week one, we learned that this new path is an exclusive path, because I believe the Bible teaches that everyone who wants to know and have a relationship with the living God must come to him through Jesus, who gave his life so that he could give us life. Also in week one, I gave you a definition of the church, and I reminded you of that definition last week, and I want to read it for you again today. It goes like this: the church of Jesus Christ is made up of people who have experienced the personal redemption that he secured through his life and sacrifice for the sins of the world. Jesus offers everyone the opportunity to experience transformation through an act of his grace. And it is that grace that radically changes our hearts and lives and binds us together with other Christ followers, creating an unstoppable spiritual movement of allegiance to Jesus, so that we, as transformed followers of Christ, take him with us into the marketplaces of our lives. The thing that needs to be reset in our thinking is that ministry is tied to a location or a building in order for it to count. I'm sure we love our church. We especially love this church because for over 240 years, it has been a faithful witness for the spiritual transformation and the changed lives that God has brought into this fellowship. But this building is just a building, and we need to remember that. It is a place where the church comes together to share our common bond in Jesus. Christ followers need to be challenged to reinvigorate the idea that ministry for Jesus counts no matter where it happens. Jesus is the one who empowers ministry. He is the one who sustains it. We need to understand that when we come together here on Sunday, we come for worship and study. We come to share and celebrate and encourage each other about what we've learned and what we are learning in the process of following and obeying the values and ideals of Jesus. Reset is a series dedicated to the idea that followers of Christ need to get back to the basics of what empowers our faith. And once we renew our allegiance to being and doing what the Bible asks us to be, then we can truly live our lives as authentic reflections of Jesus in the world. Reset calls us back to those foundational principles of our faith: to love Jesus and to love others the way Jesus loved them. In doing that, the church will ultimately change the world we live in. Now, for sake of review, let me share with you the first two resets we've already discussed this month. Reset number one said, confronting people with the power and authority of Jesus. Remember that week we looked at Mark chapter 5, where Jesus was confronted by a man in a cemetery. The man was controlled by demons, but that man recognized the authority of Jesus as soon as he saw him. Reset number two said forgiveness and do-overs are possible with Jesus. And we looked at two cases of that from the New Testament. One in John chapter 8, the woman who was caught in adultery. The other was in Luke 19, the story of Zacchaeus, the wee little man. that Jesus had lunch with, and his whole life turned around. This morning, as we move on in the series, I want to focus on an aspect of Jesus' character that made him so attractive to the folks he ministered to. Many of the ministry stories we see in the gospel show Jesus as a leader who showed compassion and care for the people who came into his life. No matter where Jesus went, there was always a crowd. People always flocked to where Jesus was. Yes, they were drawn to him because of the many signs and the miracles he performed, obviously. But they also were there because of the words that he spoke to people. His words, which were backed up by his actions, allowed people to catch a glimpse of God. He brought the intentions of God down to a face-to-face encounter with people. He personalized faith in life-changing and radically transforming ways. You see, many who lived in Jesus' day found that religion, or those who were supposedly ambassadors for religion, were often the very ones who made no room for those they deemed unworthy or unacceptable, irredeemable. It was difficult for the average person to have a meaningful audience with a religious leader. Often people found themselves estranged and religiously neglected, and they had no access to God. Religion kept personal faith away from the people by imposing standards on them that were too difficult to live with. They were so encased in legalistic tradition and rules that common folks had no real hope of ever achieving acceptance by God or finding peace in their personal lives. But when Jesus came, he initiated a new religious economy in the world. Not only did he speak as someone having great authority, who truly represented God, but he spoke as one who wanted to have a relationship with people. And he took folks off guard with how much he knew about them. And more importantly, what he wanted to bring to their lives. This leads us to the third reset issue this morning, which is this: lives characterized by genuine compassion and care. One of the mandates the Bible assigns the church is that if we are to be people who want to follow Jesus, then we're going to have to live like he lived. Many pushed back against Jesus' words. But how do you push back against the extraordinary acts of compassion and care that he demonstrated all the time in his ministry? You see, today I think that the church has become somewhat impressed with itself. We're impressed with our accumulated theological knowledge. And we're more than happy to engage in theological debates. Sometimes we think those debates demonstrate our knowledge of God. But sometimes all they do is divide us into sparring camps. We often fail to demonstrate our knowledge about God, our understanding of theology, by letting it affect our behavior, by like living the way Jesus lived. Doing what God tells us to do. Showing the kind of compassion and care that attracted people to him. I wonder how many personal testimonies begin with something that sounds like, "Their act of genuine kindness showed me that I needed to rethink what my life was all about, where my life was headed. Did anyone really care about me? He or she showed me that by the way they treated me, the way they accepted me, the way they loved me." You see, most of us will never leave a legacy of our faith by writing books or preaching sermons or teaching classes full of admiring students. Instead, we will leave a legacy of faith by the folks we befriended, folks who were lost and lonely, and we show them acts of kindness and compassion that lets them know what Jesus looks like. Throughout the New Testament, there were many who were touched by his caring hands and words. I want to revisit Mark chapter 5 with you again today. You'll remember that when we were in this chapter 2 weeks ago, Jesus went with his disciples across the Sea of Galilee, and when they landed on shore in a cemetery. Wasn't the disciples' first choice, I'm sure. And as soon as they got there, someone came out from the cemetery and recognized the authority of Jesus and begged for mercy. Today we're going to look at a divine appointment that happened right after that cemetery incident. Jesus crossed over the Sea of Galilee once again, and he found two very needy people whose lives were racked with pain and trouble. Mark chapter 5, verse 21 says, "And when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him, and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, 'My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live.' And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years and who had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, 'If I touch even his garments, I will be made well.' And immediately the flow of blood dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turned about in the crowd and said, 'Who touched my garments?'" Intertwined in this passage are two distinct stories of hurting people who had reached the end of their rope. And they were coming to Jesus as a last resort. A man and a woman whose worlds were completely different, but whose needs were both critical and the same. The man was the father of a very sick little girl. She's 12 years old. We're not told what the nature of her illness was, but we are told it was life-threatening. The woman in the crowd had been suffering from a disease herself. She had been suffering for 12 years, the entire life of the man's daughter. She had been suffering with this disease, and it left her penniless. It left her broken. She had gone to physician after physician. They had tried everything. Nothing had worked. What the two seem to have in common is the fact that they had heard of Jesus' ability to heal sick people and restore them. Perhaps they had witnessed his ministry at another location, or maybe they had heard the story circulate about his miraculous intervention in the lives of people. In any case, his reputation had preceded him, and it drew them to him that day. I'm struck as I read this story about the courage it would have taken for these two people to step forward in such an overt way and request that Jesus hear them, that Jesus listen to them. First, the text tells us that the man was one of the rulers of the synagogue. He was someone who was looked up to and respected. He was an important person. His position would have been responsible for the administrative details in the synagogue. All of the officials knew him, which heightened the risk he was taking just coming to Jesus. But as a father, he had taken every opportunity to meet the needs of his family. I think he had tried everything. He tried everything. He tried to get someone to fix his daughter. But she kept getting sicker and sicker. So he was frantic for a solution. I wondered if perhaps this father had been present when Jesus healed the man with a withered hand back in Mark chapter 3. As a result of that healing, the Pharisees became more incensed, and they were determined to destroy Jesus and his ministry because, first of all, they believed he violated the Sabbath, but more importantly, they saw Jesus as standing between them and the pure Jewish way of life. He could hurt us, This movement could destroy what we are comfortable with. So Jesus was considered a threat, and a plan to kill him had already been initiated. Even if this official Jairus, who came to Jesus here in chapter 5, had not been present to witness the healing in chapter 3, he would have at least known about it. He would have known that the Jewish world also expected him, as a leader in the synagogue, to be on board with the plans they had about getting rid of Jesus, the threat to their system. So for him to come to Jesus now and bow down and ask him for such a request was putting his life literally at risk, and certainly his whole reputation was being put at risk. But I don't think Jesus was looking at Jairus as a synagogue official here. Instead, I think he was looking at him as a hurting dad with a desperate need. A need that he knew he could meet. And he wanted to show compassion, and he wanted to have care for this man and his family. And because of that compassion and the predicament he was in, Jesus agreed to go with Jairus to his house. But on the way, there was another interruption. Now, I don't think we can fully appreciate the predicament the woman in the story was in. This bleeding disease that she suffered from was a disease that stigmatized her in her culture. We're not told how she happened to contract it, but she had been on a 12-year search for a solution to the disease, and all the physicians that she had contacted had been unable to help her. It kept getting worse. One of the ramifications of having a disease like this, a blood disease, was that the priest would have declared her ceremonially unclean. So she could not enter the court of women at the temple. She couldn't mix with other Jewish families. She was isolated. She was alone. She was set apart. Her entire social and emotional life was compromised because of the designation. She also would have been required, when out in public, if she were walking down the street, to announce to the people that she met that were coming out, "I'm unclean, I'm unclean," so that there would be no danger of them coming and touching her and therefore making themselves unclean. So for 12 years, this has been her life. But on this day, she sees an opportunity to approach Jesus for healing, because by that time Jesus was known as the healer and people were coming to him in great numbers. So she saw him as her last best hope for a solution. She had determined that all she had to do was touch his garment. She wouldn't need to talk to him. She wouldn't need to get his attention. Her faith said, if I could just touch his garment, I know I'll be healed. She wanted to be discreet so that she would not bring attention to herself. In order to have her life restored after the healing, she would have to go to a priest, prove to the priest that she had been healed, and wait for that priest to declare her clean before she could resume her normal life. But the first step was coming to Jesus. So she came to him, made her way through the crowd, touched the hem of his garment, and then it says she knew immediately she had been healed. I'm not sure she expected that. I'm not sure she expected to feel the healing in her body. Her plan, I think, was to shrink back and remain hidden. But Jesus felt the power go out of his body, the power of healing. And he turned and he said, "Who touched me?" The disciples were taken back, and he said, "Master, look around you. Look at all these people pressing in on you. No one's socially distanced. Everyone's touching you." But then the healed woman finally came forward and told Jesus her truth, her whole story. So in a wonderful display of compassion and care, Jesus said to her, "Your faith has made you well. Go in peace be healed of your disease. And because he cared for her, she was healed. Do you think her life was ever the same after this? I don't. Do you think she ever got over this act of grace? Do you think she ever stopped talking about Jesus? About what happened to her? About being healed? Wow. Jesus and Jairus finally resumed their journey to Jairus' house, but on the way, crippling news was delivered to them. Look at verse 35. While he was still speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping." Put yourself in the Father's place again right now. Everyone in your world is telling you it's all over. She's dead. It's finished. Give up your hope about her being healed and restored. And basically, give up on Jesus. There's no doubt of her death. The mourners have already come. Death customs are already in place. There was protocol that happened when someone died. All those things were already in place. But Jesus looks at the Father and said, "Come with me. Come with me and believe." So he goes into the room where the daughter was lying. And he takes the little girl's hand. And Jesus raises her back to life. Do you think he was ever the same after that? Did he ever get over that act of grace and compassion? Even though Jesus told him not to tell anyone what had happened, do you think he could keep that quiet or keep it a secret? It's a picture of a Savior who cares about a parent's worst nightmare and then does something about it. There's a passage in the book of Romans that talks about the marks of a true Christian. It's found in Romans chapter 12, and it says, "Let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. Do not be slothful in zeal. Be fervent in spirit. Serve the Lord. Rejoice in hope. Be patient in tribulation. Be constant in prayer. Contribute to the needs of the saints and seek to show hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight." This morning's text showed us what compassion looks like from Jesus' perspective. And then Paul challenges the Roman church that followers of Christ are supposed to follow his example and let the world see him through their compassion and care for each other. In my research, I found a modern day example of a compassion and care ministry that was started as a means of showing Jesus to an otherwise forgotten segment of society. In November 2004, a ministry was birthed in the city of Nashville, Tennessee, out of a desire to feed and clothe that city's homeless and underserved population. That ministry is called The Bridge. The Bridge got its name because of the location where it operates. Before COVID, every Tuesday night, between 300 and 500 folks met and received a hot meal, new clothing, and then they enjoyed a worship service under the 17th Street Bridge in the city of Nashville. The leaders of the ministry had as their goal to bring the church to the people who lived under the bridge, because many of those people felt the church had abandoned them. The founder and CEO of the bridge is a woman named Candy. It is a somewhat unusual journey that brought her to that particular ministry. You see, Candy had always been in Christian ministry. She comes from a legendary Southern gospel music family, and she grew up traveling and singing with her family. They accumulated many Dove Awards, as did she, and she was regularly at the top of Christian music charts. She married a man named Kent who became a pastor and a full-time evangelist and has been for the majority of their marriage. Together, the couple developed a passion for helping the less fortunate in Nashville, and the bridge was born. In an interview that I watched with Candy, she shared about a time in her life when she suffered from a very dark depression. She said that for 2 years, she felt lost. My life had all the earmarks of Christian success and happiness, but that's not what my day-to-day experience looked like. I felt sad. I felt lost. I was looking for something to fill a void in my life, and I didn't understand why the void was there in the first place. That's when an older pastor friend of mine asked me if I wanted to help him one day take some food to some homeless people that he knew. I was raised in Louisiana, and I'm a good cook. I make a mean jambalaya. So I went with him with my big pot of jambalaya that night, and it began to change my life. It was like something came back to life in me. So I kept going back week after week after week, which eventually led me to establish the Bridge Ministry. One of the remarks that struck me in Candy's interview was a question that was raised to her by one of her new friends living under the bridge. As Candy's group brought the gospel every week to folks who often had been ignored and overlooked by the church, one of the clients said to her, "But will your gospel work for me?" Candy spent her entire life in the church, but had never thought about that question. She now believes that by showing compassion and showing care and meeting the needs of hurting people, they are allowed to develop a trust that eventually leads them to Jesus. So the church that she took under the bridge gave hope for the people who had none. Currently, the bridge operates a 20,000 square foot warehouse in Nashville. It houses all kinds of food, canned food, fresh vegetables, new clothing, toilet items, kids' packet. Every week, volunteers come in and pack bags of food to give to children so that they will have something to eat for the weekend. The pack has enough for 12 meals to last them all week. During the week, this ministry operates metro school distribution centers. So they feed kids all week and then give them food for the weekend. You see, the bridge epitomizes the compassion and care that Jesus asks all of his followers to show the world. Lives characterized by genuine care and compassion. I think a legitimate question for us to ask ourselves is this: does my life reflect the kind of care and compassion that Jesus had for folks who felt they had been abandoned? Do the folks I come in contact with every day, do they see that level of compassion and care in me? Or do I walk right past them? A legitimate question for us to ask our own church: what are some of the things we do that show the world we care about them? And we do many things. We have food drives. We have work projects in this community down into West Virginia. We gather school supplies in the fall and coats in the winter. We do a lot of projects like this. But what else is God asking of our church? What other areas of ministry do we need to explore? Maybe there's another Candy sitting in this sanctuary who God has burdened with a ministry desire and you fought it and you're not sure that you should even voice it. Another legitimate question for all of us to ask God today. Father, how can I show your love? How can I show your compassion to my neighbors, to the kids I go to school with, to my coworkers, to the angry people in traffic, to the people in my household who need to experience it? Next Sunday, we're going to look at a fourth reset issue, and it's about serving. It goes hand in hand with this one. But we live in a world that needs to see the compassion and care of Jesus, and it needs to see the church rise up and take an active role in that. I believe that with all my heart. Think about it. Think about what God is asking of you. Stand with me for prayer. Father, I pray that you would look at us carefully today and remind us that, Lord, there are people in our life that we may never have even noticed that need to see the compassion of Jesus through us. God, teach us how to be compassionate, caring people. Sometimes it seems like a monumental task. Take us down to the basics. Retrain us, Lord, to be the people you've called us to be, to live like Jesus in the world where you've placed us. And Father, we will be obedient and we will be careful. We will learn to love the way you love us. In the name of Jesus, God's people said, Amen.